The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
The Contrarian Investor Podcast wants to find the best and give them a voice. To help in our search, we use Covey to find and track the best contrarians. Our guests' stock picks are available in real time on the website covey.io/contrarian. Now, these portfolios are available for anyone to view, track, and share. And on top of that, we encourage our listeners to join our community by building virtual portfolios of stocks and ETFs to compete and rise to the top. At the end of the year, we'll interview the top performing analyst on Covey, right here on the Contrarian Investor Podcast. That means you or any great contrarians you know can rise to the top based on merit and get a voice. Again, the website, covey.io/contrarian. Here we're with Aaron Peck of the Value Investing Substack, joining us from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. We're going to jump off with something very familiar to U.S. audiences, which is a certain chip stock by the name of Intel Corporation, INTC stock ticker. This is a stock that has kind of not done very well. Over the last year, it's down 31%. Over the last 5 years, it's down 40%. It's kind of gone nowhere. And yet you, Aaron, are bullish. Talk to me about that.
Sure. So Intel is basically one of the only 3 semiconductor fabs in the world, which are capable of making leading-edge chips. Leading-edge chips are basically those below 7 nanometers and below in density, transistor density. So obviously the first one, the highest performer now is TSMC. That's in Taiwan. The second highest performer is Samsung, which is in South Korea. And Intel is the third one. So there are only 3 real companies that can do this in the entire world. And this is a geopolitical thesis where chips, leading edge chips, are of national strategic importance to the US, where the other side of the table is China. And TSMC and Samsung both happen to be in a little bit close proximity to China. So Intel is really the only horse that the US can bet in this race.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. So you say that these other stocks have ties to China. Taiwan, though, is something, and these are both U.S. allies, Korea and Taiwan. Taiwan maybe unofficially, depending on if it's even a country, whatever. Leave that alone for now. But you don't think that that would be enough for them to not lose market share to Intel?
Well, the thing is that From the perspective of national strategic importance, right, this is something that the US can't do without. So Taiwan being as close as it is to China, there is geopolitical risk. Let's just put it that way, right? No question. Samsung, while it is a Western ally, it is its priority is North Korea, not the West, right? And with North Korea being allied to China, if push comes to shove, you know, I imagine they pick their own local priorities over those of the US. Mm-hmm. And so that's, again, not something you can count on, right? Mm. I'm not saying that they're not important or significant. They are, but they're not something you can bet on the way the US can bet on Intel. Right. And let's be clear, even if the former two outperform Intel going forward, there's enough TAM in the world, right, for the three to share the pie.
Okay. So, all right. So let's talk to me a little bit about Intel's business, what these chips are used for, and because they don't compete with the AMDs of the world. These are mostly PC chips. Is that right? Fill me in.
Sure. Okay. So just to start with Intel's business, they actually have two distinct segments. One is their legacy, we call them fabless segment, where they're just doing the design of the chips. So Apple only has the fabless part, right? AMD only has the fabless part. They send the designs to TSMC to be manufactured into the physical world. That's called the fab. So Intel has both. That's what we call an IDM, integrated device manufacturer, right? And up to now, Intel has not outsourced their fabs, but they are having, in light of the new geopolitical tensions, about a year or two ago, Intel actually announced that it will start allowing third parties to outsource their designs to their fabs. So this new segment is called IFS. Basically, now NVIDIA can send their designs to Intel to fab instead of TSMC, right? So that's where the geopolitical significant part come in, because there is literally no other leading edge fab in the States, right? And if, you know, Samsung and TSMC end up being unreliable for any reason, then that might be a problem, not just for Intel, but for NVIDIA, AMD, Apple. We can go down to this. So yeah, that's correct.
Got it. Yeah, and I see here a news report just from April 12th, a couple of days ago, as we report this. Intel rises as it says it will work with ARM on next-gen manufacturing mobile chips. So it looks like some of this business is already coming home. But why hasn't the market caught on to this? This information. I mean, look, over the last 6 months, Intel is up 20%. So maybe they are. And over the last month, it's up 7%. So it looks like maybe it's already bottom. Is that why you think? Or
chips are basically a very commoditized cyclical industry, which is a proxy to the global economy, right? And as you can probably tell, aggregate global demand has been on the decline for a while due to the recent rate hikes. So chips, it's a double whammy from firstly, the tech bubble bursting in October 2021. And on top of that, the massive rate hikes that have happened since, let's call it February 2022, okay? So putting those two together. And on top of that, the peak of the supply-demand balance was in October 2021. So it's both a macro problem as well as a sector-specific cyclical problem, which is contributing to the share price underperformance.
Okay.
But importantly, as long as Intel doesn't have any going concern risk, cycles always recycle. So that's sure. My position.
Yeah. So you think that we're now at the start of a new expansionary cycle for the economy? Or is that
I do not necessarily think that this is a year-long trade, for instance, mm-hmm. right? Because the fabs probably won't be up until 2025 at the earliest. Right, but in terms of just long-term fundamental value, I am value investing Substack after all. Similar to Oxy with Buffett, I think there's a very similar story here where it's quite hard to imagine Intel staying at 16 times trough earnings mm-hmm. for perpetuity, right? I mean, we're talking about Intel here. We're not talking about some small cap semiconductor testing company in Southeast Asia.
Right, right. Okay. What else can you tell me about the business as far as the fundamentals or any of those other metrics?
Sure. So I think the way I'll address this is in two parts. The first part is that most people are worried that Intel will repeat its underperformance of the past decade, right? Because it, as we all know, it basically made some wrong choices, and then it underperformed TSMC quite significantly. So the reason for that is basically that Intel, after inventing the EUV technology, they decided not to go ahead and use it because of efficiency or yield concerns, right? And TSMC basically took a risk, operational risk, and decided to use EUV. And the rest is history, right? EUV turned out to work. Intel relied on the older technology, which is lithography, at 193 nanometers versus EUV's 13 nanometers. So it's an order of magnitude, right? And Intel basically continued on its multi-patterning route. So that's where you overlay several patterns, and that increases the risk of error. That increases operational and logistical complexity, and that results in lower yields ultimately. And with chips ultimately being a commoditized business, if you have lower yields, you basically underperform quite badly, right? So what's the remedy to this? Well, a lot of bears of Intel basically say that we need Intel needs another decade to catch up to TSMC, right? Which is what you would expect if EUV had to be developed internally. But the good news is that EUV is actually developed by an external party called ASML, right? It's a monopoly in the world of EUV machines. And Intel, as we speak, has already bought the machines from ASML. They do not need to R&D, right? They do not need to cultivate R&D for the next 10 years to develop their own EUV machines. All they need to do is buy it. And, you know, with things being as important as they are, they could easily, you know, poach a couple of employees from TSMC to get the ball rolling almost immediately. So I'm not saying that it's an overnight thing, no, but it's not a 10-year thing, right? At most, it's a one-year learning curve, make some mistakes, recover, right? It's not the same as having to develop EUV internally and catch up to TSMC. So I think the risk of innovation lag to TSMC is very immaterial, right? And the second thing that I was going to say is that in the chip world, there are basically two types. One is called CISC. One is called RISC. CISC is a proxy for x86, x64, right? You've heard of this before. RISC is a proxy for ARM, A-R-M. So the short version is that CISC is going to lose to RISC over time due to structural disadvantages, right? But here's the thing. We do not need to rely on Intel's fabless business. This geopolitical thesis is entirely about their fab business. And Intel will be able to accept orders from Apple, right? Which is doing RISC, which is doing ARM. So if we put aside the fabless business and just focus on the fab part, the question then becomes, can they say match TSMC one day in terms of performance, right? And that's another story which I want to go into later. Yeah. But still, right, you can easily see how the x86 as well as the past decade of underperformance is not really a factor in terms of the long-term fundamentals of Intel.
Yeah. It sounds like this would be a kind of, from what you're saying, a no-brainer for Apple to use Intel as they move out of China, move their production out of China, which they've already said they're going to do. Has there been any talk about them actually using Intel yet, or how they're going to go about that?
So Intel has not actually started the IFS yet. They're in the middle of building the fabs. I think end of last year, they actually took, I forgot what's the value. They took a huge loan from Brookfields, right, to basically build out the shell of the fab. So the shell is just the structure of the fab, the building, without the machines inside. And what building out the shell first means that it's very easy to just transplant machines in and start running, right? As opposed to having to build the whole building from scratch. So it's already in the works. No, they do not have orders from Apple yet, nor do I think they have orders from any of the big guys yet. But here's the thing. Apple has historically played fabs against each other for price competitive reasons. So they played TSMC against Samsung, right? I'm sure you've heard of the stories about 5 years ago where there were different kinds of quality in terms of the Apple chips in the iPhones. and customers were complaining. Mm. So that's what Apple does, right? And if you can have three competitors instead of two to get the best price for yourself, keep in mind that there are only three companies in the whole world in this sector, right? I see that as a likely possibility, right? If not, almost a sure thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, so there's your catalyst then, potentially, if Apple does make an announcement that they are going to use Intel. How far away are Intel's fab productions from getting online?
So like I said, the IFS segment is nascent, mm-hmm. and the first fabs will at the earliest come into production in 2025,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you were talking about base case, it's probably 2028. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing, right? By the time 2025 comes and the visibility is clear, the valuation wouldn't be at this level anymore. And if their actual fabless performance goes up due to, let's say, the economy recovering, it's a double whammy to the upside, right?
Mm-hmm.
Upside risk, right? So not to say that this is the absolute troll, the absolute bottom, but it's as good as it gets. 16x troll earnings for pretty much oligopoly, global oligopoly, right? You're comparing this to the likes of Coca-Cola, Apple, right? We're talking about massive, massive mega caps.
Yeah.
Not mid caps, right?
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Cool. Now talk to me. You mentioned Occidental Petroleum. Different business, still cyclical. Why do you like that stock?
So Oxy is a very unique oil and gas E&P super major, right? E&P being exploration and production. Mm-hmm. So 70% of their business is oil and gas. They have 20% in chemicals and 10% in others, right? So we're just going to focus on oil and gas side because chemicals is notoriously volatile. So on the oil and gas side, as you know, they bought Anadarko in 2019 and basically doubled their production overnight. And right now, management has committed publicly to paying for the acquisition. At the same time, limiting production growth to 5%. So in terms of shareholder return expectations, it's very straightforward. We are going to pay down the debt. We're going to pay the preferreds, the Berkshire preferreds, which yield 8%. And we're going to return all, focus all our efforts on increasing a common dividend. Right. So for E&P super majors, the benchmark valuation metric is dividend yield or total shareholder return if you include buybacks. So in Oxy's case, they have a lot of incentive to do more buybacks, which I'll go into later. But basically, you can compare it to the dividend yield of most competitors because they mostly return the capital in terms of dividends, right? And the average of the top 14 super majors. Sorry, 13, I think, is 4.7% shareholder return, right? Dividend yield. Whereas with Oxy, it starts at 6%, right? Worst case, 5.5, assuming they do some share buybacks. And what Buffett is seeing, which I'll explain later, is up to 11%. And all these are under the base case assumption of $80 oil prices, which I'll go into later, is likely to stay or go above because global oil supply is super, super tight.
Yes, it is. But we do have economic headwinds, you know, slowing housing in the U.S., potentially employment, a lot of talk of recession, which would historically has been and will be bad for oil stocks and for oil prices in general. So there is that concern as well, is there not?
Yes. So in terms of demand, definitely it's still uncertain, right? But what is beyond certain is the fact that your global oil supply is super tight. So if you're really thinking in terms of long-term, right, the way Buffett does, this is as good as it gets for a super major, E&P super major.
Hmm.
6% dividend yields is pretty damn good, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, compare that to ExxonMobil's 3.2, Chevron's 3.5, EOG's 2.7, right? And even those on a lower tier, right? Like Hess is 1.2, right? So obviously these are all not apples to apples comparison, but 6 is a pretty good margin of error.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're talking about 6 after the preferreds. Right. So once those preferreds are paid over the long term, let's call it 8 years, right? Which, right? I mean, it depends on you. That goes up to 11, based on very reasonable assumptions of $80 oil.
Mm.
Right. If my base case for oil is way above 80, okay. So let's say it goes up to 100. At the bottom of my report, there's actually a distribution sensitivity analysis. So at $100 oil, it goes up to 13.8%.
Hmm.
At 120, it goes up to 16.6%.
Hmm.
And at 150, it goes up to 20.7%. These are all dividend yields, right?
Hmm.
So, you know, if you're a buffer and you have $128 billion of cash burning a hole in your pocket, right?
Which, of this course, is, we all do. Who doesn't have $128 billion in their pocket?
I have $2 trillion, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have more than that, but yeah. Interesting. Wow. Okay, that's cool. And here too, the stock kind of hasn't gone anywhere over the last year. It's up 2.5%. What's the year to date? It was down yesterday. So yeah, it seems that these oil stocks, these cyclicals, just kind of can't really get out of their own way. They look to have a bit of a rally, but it seems like you're saying you're still, yeah, you're long-term bullish here on the stock, if only for the income that is provided by the dividend and the buybacks.
Right. I think the nature of value investing is that you kind of have to be contrarian, in a sense that's the easiest places to get opportunities,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you could compete with the Blackstones and JP Morgans of the world in the short term, or you could just admit that you're maybe not as good as them and stick to a long term and make the same amount of money in the long term, right? So, yeah.
That's the premise of this podcast, of course, is that, you know, the contrarian ideas, they're not always right, but they're at least worth taking into consideration.
Correct.
Interestingly, we don't talk all that much about individual stocks here. It's more about the economy, but we should. And on that, do you have any other contrarian ideas you want to discuss before we get to break? We can also leave them for the second half of the show if you have any.
I've got to think about it because there's nothing that comes to mind immediately.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's fine. All right, let's take a quick break here. Aaron Peck of Value Investing Substack. I want to come back, ask you some more about yourself, your background, your Substack, and some other stuff. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. If you are a premium subscriber, don't touch the dial. We will not go anywhere. You will not get the break. We'll be right back. In fact, we already are. And anybody else who wants to become a premium subscriber, please visit the website, contrarianpod.substack.com. And sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server. They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack that you can, where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details, contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com. Whole bunch of benefits, including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets, such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show. Welcome back, everybody. Here with Aaron Peck of Value Investing Substack. I mentioned it at the outset, you are based in KL, Malaysia, just north of Singapore there, for those who haven't been to the region. But so curious how you came to this line of work, I guess, what your background is, what your origin story is as an investor, to put things in Marvel terms, and yeah, how you came to start the Substack and some other stuff. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so growing up, I always wanted to be a businessman because my dad was one. So I know I read your Robert Kiyosaki's, your highly effective seven highly effective habits, right? I never really touched investing until I did my ACCA in my postgraduate. So ACCA is basically the equivalent to CFA, but on the accounting side, right? And that's when I actually discovered Buffett, because there is a finance component to it. And basically, shortly prior to that, I realized that business just wasn't for me, because it's very risky, right? It's really high risk, high reward. And you know, I actually did see what the fallout of a failed business was like. So you know, I was a little bit sad by that point, right? That I didn't think business was for me. So value investing really appealed to me, right? The Warren Buffett way. Because if you think about what value investors do, we invest long term and we analyze companies like businesses, which is pretty much similar to what a CEO does, other than the actual people management part, right? Because CEOs don't move barrels and warehouses. They also sit behind spreadsheets. They look at financial statements. They make data with, they make decisions with slightly more granular data than public information, but papers nonetheless, right? They're not really moving stuff around. So this really appealed to me because it was both, I was both able to, you know, think like a businessman while diversifying my risk, right? So it was the best of both worlds for me. And then over time, I spent more times in, you know, global value investing communities, like Value Investing Club, security analysis on Reddit, right? And then I spent a lot of time there. And when the Substack trend started taking off, all the financial bloggers moved to Substack. I just thought, why not, right? And then out of pure luck, I just tried to grab the URL, the subdomain valueinvesting.substack.com. And I got it. So that's the genesis of my my newsletter story. And, right. And then since I was organically passionate about it, you know, I just started writing about it.
When did you start the Substack?
I actually started it in, if I'm not wrong, January 2020. I could be wrong. Slightly on the fence, but I only went paid and started doing this full time October 2021. So it was nearly 2 years after I started.
Interesting. Okay. That's about as long as this Substack has been around. But, and what was, so were you involved in any professional capacity as an investor, an analyst, or anything like that before?
Yes. I was a fund manager shortly before I started this.
Okay.
So I was basically a fund manager for, I was running, or I was supervising, you know, $100 million fund. And it was an Asia ex Japan fund as well as a Malaysia fund. So, but I also, out of just pure interest, spent a lot of time understanding both US and China markets.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. I am familiar with global macro to a certain extent.
Yeah. Do you have any views on potentially any, I would think this would be where you could really add value, because everybody knows about Oxy and Intel, but nobody knows about, you know, what any publicly traded stocks in Malaysia or even Singapore or other areas, other countries in the region. So if you have any, wondering if you have any thoughts about that, either that or even macroeconomically about those countries.
Sure. So let's talk about stocks first. And then if you have time, we go into the macro, right?
Yeah.
So I actually do like one company very much. And ironically enough, it's also an oil and gas, E&P.
Hmm.
It's a small cap this time, right? But I'm going to try and keep it as brief as possible. So it's a Malaysian oil and gas small cap, whose management team I call, or the MD, I call the Indian Warren Buffett of Southeast Asian oil and gas. So here's the reason why, right?
They're basically, what's the company?
It's called Hibiscus Petroleum. And what's really unique about them is that they're not really greenfield the way you might expect small cap E&Ps to be, right? They are actually brownfield operators. So their bread and butter is acquiring lagging fields and then using enhanced recovery methods to basically boost the production. And by virtue of having a lower overhead, you know, still be profitable at those rates. But it's a very free cash flow generative focus, as well as a low OPEX focus, right? And where they really make all their money is in the upfront acquisition costs of the business. So a good example of their modus operandi is about 1.5 or 2 years ago, they acquired oil and gas field from Vietnam, right? The authorities there, from Repsol, the global oil and gas operator, which was basically 3 times their revenue, their site, their production. So the way they did that was by funding the acquisition with equity amidst low oil prices of 2020, right? Keep in mind that the equity had fallen by about 50% in that time. So the way they made money was that they actually acquired the assets from Repsol at fire sale asset prices, right? And therefore, there was a spread between the cost of equity and the return on equity. Keep in mind, they were funding the entire acquisition with equity. So when your share price drops, your cost of equity goes up, right? But because they bought Repsol at a low equity value, their return on equity went up due to the oil price dropping. And therefore, there was a spread, right? So obviously, all this is complicated from 30,000 feet. But from the point of view of management who has granular data, it's a simple question of, does it increase my EPS? So obviously, it did, right? But if you think about the business model, it's really very similar to a bank's interest rate spread, because both the cost as well as the benefit are moving parts. They're moving goalposts, right? And they move together with wider global oil prices. So as long as the spread increases, that's when they strike. And by funding it completely with equity, they are completely net cash almost all the time. There is no going concern risk the way you might imagine most E&P companies might have. So combine the two, right? It's both very conservative, very contrarian. They do nothing for 5 years, then go out and make an acquisition 3 times their size and staying net cash throughout the cycle, while all the competitors are loading up on debt to take advantage of high oil prices and new opportunities, right? They are a truly contrarian company, as both our namesakes, like. And the management style is very similar to how I imagine Warren Buffett approaches oil and gas. And it's also a coincidence, right, that they are an oil and gas E&P, which focuses on enhanced oil recovery, the same way Oxy's bread and butter is.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating. I just looked here. There is a gray sheets listing here in the U.S., very liquid. HIPEF is that ticker. It trades on the KL Stock Exchange under HIBISCS, which is obviously going to be more liquid. Obviously, there's going to be some currency risk there. But is that the type of thing that investors should be concerned about? Obviously, it's always something a major concern, but Malaysia is pretty stable these days, right?
So the headline view of Malaysia is that it's the 1MDB saga, right? Which is basically kleptocracy and nepotism. But as someone who actually lives here, I can say that the top-down view of Malaysia doesn't really represent how the economy functions, right? Our politics at the top is quite messy, but our institutions are actually very robust relative to our neighbors. So if you think about something like Indonesia, you think about something like the Philippines, right? Vietnam, Thailand is something that you guys also know, right? Mm-hmm. The economy, their economies really flip at the switch in terms of macro. Whereas Malaysia's institutions are actually very, very strong, right? I've actually had the pleasure of reading our central bank governor announcements, as well as understanding the intricacies of how our bourses try and develop the stock markets, right, and derivative markets, as well as the cultivation of CBDC and inter-region, inter-country, right, payment networks. So one was just linked with Singapore. Right now, we can use QR codes with Singapore from our Malaysian phones. So there's a lot of emerging market development, let's just put it that way, right? And I'm not trying to say that the risk here is lower than developed markets, definitely not. But if you're talking about emerging markets, I think the risk is okay, you know? And these are not just my sentiments. I've had a friend from the UK visit, and he visited about 12 years ago, right? And then he just came again last year, or this year, I think. And he said the difference was night and day in terms of development. You know, we have grown so much. And those are his words, right? So come to KL, you know, have a look for yourself. It's what, $2,000 for a flight ticket? Enjoy a holiday here or something, right? Have a look. Visit some companies. You know, if anyone visits, just hit me up on LinkedIn. Right? I'll be happy to bring you around and sample a local cuisine.
Okay, yeah. Get some.
It'll be all the hidden spots too.
Oh, that's really cool. Okay. Very cool. And there is obviously an ETF that tracks the Malaysian market, EWM, which sounds like might not be a terrible idea if you want access to growth in the region, especially in Southeast Asia, which is growing.
And in fact, I just recently wrote an article about Malaysian macro on my blog. So if you want to know more, just have a look at it.
Okay. I will link to that as well. Geopolitically, where is Malaysia in the whole China versus US thing? It seems like a lot of countries in the region have kind of broken down along that fault line with, you know, obviously Japan and Korea being US allies, Philippines being a little on the fence. Vietnam is surprisingly, perhaps given the history, a US ally now. Other parts of the, you know, the Mekong there are Chinese vassal states, for lack of a better word. But so where's Malaysia?
Okay. So Malaysia is actually quite, I would say, split down the middle, quite neutral, in the sense that Malaysia does have a 20% Chinese population, right? And I would, as a local Chinese, I think most of the Chinese population tend to side with the China side. So in terms of our Malay overlords, right, basically, and the Malays, they are 60% of the population, they have a stranglehold on the voting base, right? Mm-hmm. And they actually call the shots over the Chinese, if you read. Our political history is there. So in terms of the Malay administration, right, they're actually truly neutral. They truly do not pick sides, in the sense that they need to be worried about the Chinese voter base, right? They need their spot. But at the same time, they're very much not wanting to lean completely to China and become reliant on it, right? Mm-hmm. So the new Anwar administration, if you know him from 20 years ago, he actually has a history of being seen as a cosmopolitan, as well as being seen as a progressive. So his views are very, let's just say, democratized, right? And that's his policy. But at the same time, he needs to be realistic about his voter base, right? Which is, let's say, 50% Chinese, which is more of the progressive side of things. Now, that's the voter framework. On the more on the more economic side, right? Yes, on the more economic side, there are actually two major things that need to be mentioned. One is that because of the 20% Chinese population, right, a lot of them actually live in a small northern island called Penang, and Penang happens to be control 7% of global TAM. For trailing edge semiconductor testing equipment, right? So it's lagging edge, trailing edge, which is not, you know, Intel and TSMC's area, but trailing edge are still semiconductors are still used in cars, still used in calculators, 5G base stations, right? Stuff that are not so complicated. And China is going to become, just by virtue of the commoditized nature of the business, it's going to become a manufacturing powerhouse in that subsector. So Penang really does have a lot of economic heft in terms of even policy, right? Secondly, there is the decoupling situation of the global economy, which is seeing a lot of Western businesses move their manufacturing bases out of China to Southeast Asia, which is why I call Southeast Asia the next China of the world, right? The next factory of the world. Because we have this sweet spot where there's relative political stability, as well as relatively low labor pool costs, right? China's not so cheap anymore. And so as a result of that, there's this sweet spot of relative political stability in Southeast Asia and relatively low labor pool costs, right? Even compared to China. So that gives you the conditions for being the factory of the world, right? But there's also the, I see it's a very big recipient of FDI from both sides, West and East, over the next generation. And then in terms of decoupling, right? Yes, it's true that there's going to be friendshoring from away from China towards the US. But at the same time, there was a very recent Financial Times article, which we can link later, where basically they were saying that despite the friendshoring nations will still be very reliant on China for imports of the source raw materials, right? Because that's really where all the stuff is being made, despite them actually assembling it for final delivery to the, you know, more developed economies. And so there is still a huge economic tie to China for the foreseeable future, right? And that's why I say that Malaysia needs to play both sides. There is really, let's just say that it can play the carrot and the stick with both.
Yeah, which is also a very Asian thing. So, but you don't think that it would, with the population obviously heavily Malay and the government as well, you don't think that that would ultimately call the shots with them siding with the US if push came to shove?
I don't think so, because the Malays of Malaysia do not necessarily care about either side, right? They're not necessarily, they're truly neutral in that sense. Yeah. Or if you want to be skeptical, self-interested, right? Sure. So they lean to...
well, I mean, so is everybody, but yeah.
Correct. So the good thing about being self-interested is that, you know, you won't die for it, right? And if someone gives you a bigger pot of gold, right, you probably lean towards there. So it's really in flux who they'll actually end up backing, right? Philippines seem to have chosen a side. But I think everyone else, aside from Singapore, which is very related to the Taiwan issue, are trying their best to stay out of it, right? It's risky, right?
So going back to Malaysia real quick, so what are the major industries? Obviously, oil, Petrobras is a company everyone will have heard of. You mentioned the semiconductors there up in Penang. What other, are there any other major industries that we could know, we should know about?
Malaysia is a very heavily, surprisingly so, service sector economy, right? The service sector basically makes up half of the economy. Manufacturing makes up about 25%, and you know the rest is everything else. So manufacturing is largely export. We are a great middleman in terms of assembly, not necessarily source material manufacturing or commodities agriculture-wise. But the service sector is 50% of the economy, which is interesting for two reasons. So basically what Malaysia did very successfully during the Mahathir era of the 80s and the 90s was do the Polish model, where we basically tried to create national champions through the Chaebol model, as well as the Keiretsu in Japan, right, decades back. So there was a lot of PPP going on, where the government partnered with the private sector to create industrial champions, to create the economies of scale necessary for export to developed nations, right? So it's a very they're trying to copy the South Korean success model, and they did that with great success, but that's really just a OEM model, you could call that, right? You're basically just producing widgets for somebody else. You're not the brand owner. So they did try to create brands in terms of automotive brands like Proton, because cars are basically everything industrial, right? Mm-hmm. And you can do that. You can create a local brand for export. Then that's massively great for your industrial base. But unfortunately, we failed in terms of creating brand owners. So today, we're very akin to the Polish economy in terms of having a lot of OEM national champions like Top Glove, right? Like, Hicom, but not brand owners, right? So we're stuck with the very sliver of margin. The second thing about the service sector is that we happen to be in the low value-added manufacturing part of the global value chain, right? So you think about semiconductors, we're 7% of global TAM, but it's semiconductor testing equipment, which is relatively, in fact, it's truly commoditized and extremely fragmented industry with very low margins relative to all the other segments of the global value chain, right, in semiconductors. So, we happen to be stuck in that middle-class trap, you could call it, right, for the past 20 years, where we have been very good in terms of producing low-value-added services, right, but not really graduating to the high-value-added services, which propel the likes of Japan and South Korea into high income status. And we're getting there because I think we will reach high income status as defined by $30,000 per capita, right? Annual income by 2028, if I'm not wrong. It was supposed to be 2020. So it's been delayed by a decade, right?
Yeah, well, COVID and such.
We're nearly there, right? We're within, you know, almost there. So that's interesting, right? Because you wouldn't have imagined Malaysia to be more advanced on a per capita basis than China, for instance.
Yeah, yeah. What's your take on the global economy? I guess maybe starting with China, what do you see there in terms of, you know, the COVID reopening? Maybe hasn't quite been as big as advertised, but maybe you have a different view. And then the US and Europe and all these other things, yeah.
So I want to clarify that I'm not a China macro expert, but I'll just give my views, right, for fun. Wow. So yeah. China's main, the way I see China's main problem is their outsized property sector, right, which is about 25% of their GDP, as well as their lagging industrial sector, which has been lagging basically zombie companies for the past decade. And the situation with China's economy now, when you add their declining population base, right? Just to digress, the working age population has started declining since 2018, if I'm not wrong, right? Now it's absolute population decline, right? So you put these three factors together, right? They're basically in a very Japanification situation and accelerated so, right? And there's a lot of... So basically, the way I see China from a very 30,000 feet point of view is they're in the first innings of Japan's early 90s. And they're in they're basically having no choice but to do a smooth deleveraging for, at the very least, the next decade. It's a lost decade. Mm. That's something I'm almost very sure of.
Wow. That's kind of a contrarian take there, but okay. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Europe's the same, right? And I don't think it's really contrarian. I think this is a very consensus view, right? In the sense that...
Maybe I introduced many China bulls, but yeah, go on.
Yeah, you're right. So China is really a tale of two economies, right, Charles Dickens? So basically, they have a very high margin, high growth technology-based sector, as well as a very low margin, low growth industrial sector, right? You know, 60% of the GDP is still exports. 25% is property. I'm not sure the tech, but it's not really large. It's high growth, but it's not very large. So with the crackdown on the tech sector, I think that you know, the high growth component has been you know, normalized, and the low growth problems are still there, right? So I really don't see where the massive growth that moves the needle comes from. It's really going to be a treading water situation at best. And on top of that, you have absolute population decline, which is the worst ingredient for economic growth, right? Mm. So there's just a lot of headwinds for them to overcome from a purely capitalist point of view. Now, maybe they introduce some new model, which I'm not aware of, right? But we'll have to wait and see.
All right. That's all very interesting. Aaron Peck, you gave us a lot to talk about, a lot to think about, certainly in terms of these cyclical stocks in the US and then also over there in Malaysia. In closing, you mentioned your Substack, valueinvesting.substack.com, great domain, probably, hopefully attracts a lot of search engine traffic. Where else can people find you on the internet?
Sure. So you can hit me up on LinkedIn or Twitter. Mm-hmm. In a circular way, the links are actually on my Substack. But allow me to promote my blog a little bit, if it's okay.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
So I'm actually changing my region coverage from Southeast Asia to the US, right? I just announced it yesterday. And I'm actually raising my prices from $10 a month to $30 a month to keep up with the market rate on Substack, right? So the price hike is hitting on May 1st. All existing subscribers before then are actually automatically grandfathered into my old rates. So if you enjoy, 70% discount into perpetuity, please support me on valueinvestingsubset.com, right? And it's still $10 until May 1st, right? After which it'll be $30.
Yes, and the Twitter is valueinvestingz. I guess you weren't quite as lucky there with the domain, but then again, Twitter is probably going away very soon. So no, I don't know that, but we'll see. with the way that's mismanaged, probably. Such a dumpster fire. Anyway, that's another topic for another day. Very cool. Yeah, thanks so much for that, Aaron. And yeah, so check out, make sure you subscribe before May 1st, and you can lock in the old rate. And even at the new rate, it's a bargain for what you get. But do that and follow Aaron on all the areas mentioned. And do you use the, have you been using the notes thing?
I have not started, but I intend to soon, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying
to. Fair enough.
Yeah,
because I have, and it's pretty cool. But there's some glitches. But anyway, awesome. Well, with that, we'll thank you for listening here. And thank you, Aaron, for coming on. And with that, we will leave you. We'll be back again next week. Look forward to speaking to you then. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.